Welcome to the VHA Weekly Update number 8. My name is Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. Thank you to those members for their participation in the VHAA community app. In particular, thank you to those members who have provided updates as to their HR and IR personnel so that we can add them and ensure that they have a password and can participate in that community forum. It's going to be a crucial way by which we provide information and receive information from members over the coming years. This month, we will be commencing our rural and regional forums. This is something that we intend to do twice per year. We'll be going to each region on two occasions to meet with members, to answer questions, and to talk through the implementation issues that arise from the agreements. Starting in March, we'll be attending Ballarat on the 16th of March. That will be conducted at the Lecture Theatre at the Education Resource Centre at Ballarat Health Services. On the 22nd of March, we'll be in Bendigo, attending the La Trobe Art Institute. We'll be in Wangaratta on the 23rd of March at the Oaks Conference and Function Centre. On the 29th of March, we'll be heading to Warrnambool, there at Southwest Healthcare at the Frank Lodge Conference Centre. And then on the 6th of April, we'll be at the Central Gippsland Health Service in Sale at the Lecture Hall there. When we return in September, we'll be going to different locations within that sector, but you can expect to see us in each of those regions for the regional rural forums twice yearly in March and September each year. In addition to that, we'll have our monthly HR-IR managers meeting for Metro HR and IR managers. That will be conducted on the 1st of March. On the 8th of March is the Rural and Regional HR and IR Managers. That meeting will be conducted utilising GoToMeeting. The last GoToMeeting that we had 23 participants, which means that the level of participation amongst our rural and regional members matches that of the metros. However, there are still some rural and regional members who are yet to take part in that meeting, and we would welcome additional participants in that meeting. On the 15th of March, we'll be conducting our HR-IR Managers meeting for standalone community health centres. This is a new meeting. The first meeting occurred in February, and we had about 20 participants, which is about 60% of the sector being involved in that. That meeting will be conducted both in person for those who wish to attend the VHA offices and through GoToMeeting. For those people who are attending by GoToMeeting, either for the rural and regional meeting or for standalone community health, we do ask that you RSVP so that we can send you the appropriate link. For those standalone community health members that will be attending our office on the 15th of March, we ask that you let us know in advance for catering purposes. Those are the major meetings that have been conducted at VHA this month. Welcome to the VHA Weekly Update, where we discuss matters in greater depth that are of interest to VHA members. Joining me this week is Tim Nagel, our Principal Workplace Relations Advisor. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Stuart. Good to be here today.
Once again, Tim, would you like to do the honours with regards to this week's subject?
Yes, sure.
So for the benefit of those who might be listening on podcast, would you describe what it is that you see there under the box?
I see an album cover by the Coasters.
The Coasters. So the Coasters, for those who might not be familiar with them, were a group popular in the 50s and 60s. Most of their hits were written by the team Lieber and Stoller, who also wrote hits for Elvis Presley. But in 1958, they had a number one hit song entitled Yakety Yak. And really, so that's a segue to today's subject, which is consultation.
Yes.
So, Tim, last week we talked about dispute settlement and the fact that every agreement has a dispute settlement procedure contained within it. It's also true to say that every agreement has within it a consultation clause. Why is that?
Well, it's very similar reason to why every agreement has a dispute resolution clause, in that the Fair Work Act requires it.
And if it's not included within the agreement, then a model consultation clause applies.
That's right. So if the parties can't come up with a consultation clause, then the model clause is by course inserted into the agreement.
So the consultation provisions are in our agreements because they have to be in our agreements. We must deal with consultation. Whereabouts will people find their consultation clause?
So the consultation clause will be in Part B at the front of the agreement. In the same section as last week's dispute resolution process.
So once again, it's about that trying to achieve a greater degree of consistency with the way in which agreements are structured so that people have a better idea where they might find the provisions they're after.
That's right. And we've tried to keep it as far as practicable the same across all the agreements.
So they are close to the same, but there are a couple of notable differences which we'll get to in a moment. But the way in which those clauses begin, they begin somewhat oddly with some italicised typing which states that the clause doesn't limit the obligation of an employer to consult under occupational health and safety legislation.
That's right. So as we know, occupational health and safety has some discrete obligations in relation to consultation. This is in addition to that.
It's an interesting thing in the sense that what the clause does is prescribe when you must consult. That's not quite the same thing as when you should consult. There may be circumstances where consultation is an important or useful part of an employer's process to introduce some other kind of change that may not be major change and consultation may still occur.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a lot of power to consultation, so it's not a case in point that should only be used in certain circumstances. The employee may use it in other circumstances as well.
It's important that people recall that the consultation is part of their toolkit. That they can utilise in a range of circumstances. The clause then goes on to say that, or is headed, consultation regarding major change. And that subclause has a number of features within it, setting out basically the key ingredients as to when consultation is required.
So, yeah, so there's a two sort of trigger system for the obligations under the clause. So there needs to be a major change.
So major change is one of our key terms for this provision.
Yes, and it's a defined term within the agreement. So in order to enact the requirements of the clause, you need to have major change that has a significant effect on employees.
And significant effect is our second key term. The other thing that subclause does is it makes specific reference to technological change, which is something, of course, that health services and community health centres deal with all the time.
Yes, and look, some areas more than others, but technology and changes in technology is always going to be something that our industry in particular is going to be subjected to.
One of the key things that that same subclause does is it makes a specific reference to the requirement to consult with those people who may not be in the workplace.
Yeah, so it specifically envisions that some affected employees may be on parental leave, for instance. Mm. They still have a right to be consulted about major change that has a significant effect on them.
It should be a statement of the obvious, but it's really just covering sometimes people are out of sight and out of mind, and just a reminder that organisational change or major workplace change may have a significant effect on those people who aren't present.
Yes, I mean, if you look at something like a redundancy, if a major change causes a redundancy, I mean, that is significant for that individual, so they should be consulted through the process.
There's also another reference in that subclause to the employer ensuring that the employees and HSRs and unions can participate in that process.
So it's a requirement of the Act as well, is it, that employees can have representation through the process? And that's really to enable the process to occur. Part of the outcome is to get the best possible outcome, so more involved in terms of their expertise and their familiarity with the circumstances of the change, the better.
I think the key thing about that is that ensuring that there is an opportunity for unions and their members to engage with each other so that they can participate in the consultation process in a meaningful way.
That's right.
The clause then contains a range of definitions. And the first definition that it includes is a definition of consultation itself, which is a two-parter. It makes reference to the fact that consultation is not an announcement as simply what's about to happen, but that it's a genuine opportunity to influence the decision-maker, but that it's not joint decision-making. As neat as those words are, they're not words that we've constructed.
No, and these, I mean, this is, comes out of case law and the previous decisions by the Commission. The consultation is exactly what that says it is. It is an opportunity to generally affect the decision-maker, but it's not joint decision-making.
I think one of the things that, sometimes people make the mistake of when they're going through a consultation process is the need to defend every aspect of their proposal. Generally speaking, when major workplace change is proposed, there are some outcomes that must be achieved. But in terms of the other components, how to achieve them and how to get them, those might be matters that change during the consultation process.
Yeah, there's almost the two stages, isn't there? There's the reasons why it needs to change and then what the proposed change is. So the reasons for a change aren't necessarily changed, but the way to get there may.
So that subclause contains within it some definitions both for major workplace change and for significant effect. Starting with major workplace change, the definition there contains some elements that will be very familiar to members and have been with us really for 30 years and some that are new. So the major change definition refers to a change in the employer's program, production, organisation, physical workplace, workplace arrangement, structure or technology that is likely to have a significant effect on employees. Starting with a term like physical workplace, that might be one that is less familiar to members in the context of major workplace change. What's an example of that?
So, I mean, really we're talking about capital changes with this item. So significant redevelopments of a ward, for example, where the layout's being changed or things to that effect. Would trigger the or meet the obligations under the major change definition.
So that may have the effect of, for instance, removing an existing amenity.
That's right, yeah. So, bathrooms and showers and all these sort of facilities.
One of the challenges with regards to these definitions is that it's very difficult to write for common sense. And from time to time, members do raise instances where there have been disputes about consultation over minor matters that are not major workplace change and do not have a significant effect.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a two-trigger system. They need to meet both triggers for the clause to be enacted.
And it doesn't prevent those disputes that have previously been raised from being raised again. That is, disputes that shouldn't be present under a consultation provision. But if a party to a consultation process doesn't apply common sense, what we have generally found, or what we've always found, is that the Commission will.
That's right. Yeah, that's my experience, is that where one of the parties is trying to extend the provisions in the agreement, is the Commission is very useful in curbing that.
We've also got a definition there for measures to mitigate or avert. Again, it's a familiar expression that parties have seen within their agreements for a long period of time, but the meaning of those terms have never really been spelled out before.
No, they haven't. So we've taken an opportunity within the current agreement to really spell out how those things may operate.
So the key thing with regards to these definitions is that it is unlikely that a third party such as the Commission would take an overly technical approach. Common sense still has a role to play.
Well, I mean, change is can be difficult for both the employer and for employees. So it's really quite a person-centred approach often gets the best results as opposed to a technical provision or a technical approach. So this is about navigating change and taking people with you.
I do want to acknowledge that some members have expressed provision their concerns about that clause. One of the things I think that will be important for us is to receive notifications from members where there are disputes about these provisions so that we can keep a record of those.
Yeah, it's important with these sort of provisions that we do the evaluation process as well. So we monitor their operation and how well they're being utilised to achieve the outcomes that we think they will. So it's important to get that feedback throughout the process so that we can address it in future EBA rounds if necessary.
So just in terms of the consultation steps, just moving into the actual process itself, again, consultation has been a common factor in disputes previously, and those disputes have often focused on what consultation ought to be.
That's right, yes.
And so one of the key things that the new agreements are seeking to do is to set out the steps that will satisfy the consultation requirements.
That's right. It's almost as if the process for the consultation overcomes the actual matter you're trying to consult about. So what happens is the change gets delayed because people are arguing about what the process is.
And if I'm to think back to our discussion last week, where in the context of dispute settlement, where there was always that risk that process will overwhelm the substantive issue, the same really applies for consultation. It's about ensuring that the substantive matters remain front and centre and that process doesn't become the issue.
And that should be an obligation on both parties, to actually focus on the consultation process and why that's there, as opposed to arguing about process.
So with regards to that process, it starts with a change impact statement. For as long as I can remember, employers have referred to preparing change impact statements, even though agreements haven't expressly provided for that. But the new agreements do.
Yes, they do. And look, really, it's very difficult to affect the requirements of the Act, the clause outside of that change impact statement. Some people call it an employee impact statement, but it's the same thing. Because really it's about providing in writing what the change is and some of the impacts of the change, which you need to do in writing.
So as the author of several change impact statements in your time, what kind of tips would you pass on to people who were in a position of having to write a change impact for the first time?
I think the most important thing is to think through the change before you write the impact statement. Having said that, sometimes the impact statement helps you to think through it. But it's about being very clear about what the actual changes you're trying to implement and what the implications of that change are for those involved, both within the department but also potentially outside the department. I think it's having that sort of bigger picture about the implications and how, and then that leads you to how to manage those implications.
So effectively you're identifying two elements with regards to developing a change impact statement. First of all, about crafting the reason for the change. From my perspective, I think it's always worthwhile to really work on the language in a change impact statement so that the what you're trying to do and the reason for it is incredibly clear.
Yes, and look, it's, I mean, people, change does create an emotional response in some people. It could be seen as a threat. So it's really important to be as clear as possible and to use the most appropriate language as possible. You don't want to... You want to be very clear about what the change is and what it means for people.
I think when those documents are written, people should have the audience in mind. Mm. Oftentimes when members write change impact statements, they've been working through the issues or working up to it for a period of time and understand the change inside and out. But what the change impact statement is seeking to do is to explain to people for the first time what the change is and the reason for it. It may well be that the audience ultimately could be the commission. And it would be useful if the Commission could pick up a change impact statement and understand in very clear and simple language what it is the employer is seeking to do and why they're seeking to do it.
And look, when I've wrote them in the past, I've asked someone else to read through it, and really what I'm seeking is them to understand the purpose and what I'm seeking to do. And I think that's a good test of the effectiveness of those change impact statements. If a layperson can read it, understand what you want to do, why you want to do it, and what you want to do, then it's pretty much achieving what it needs to achieve.
I think if you can achieve clarity in that way, it's amazing how often change impact statements are written in language that is intended to sound fancy and important, but has the effect of obscuring meaning.
That's right. The worst thing you can do is issue a change impact statement and people not be clear about what you want to do or what the impact is.
And that's not uncommon.
It happens, unfortunately, and people get caught up in the process. And but really, if you pair it back, you need to explain why you're making the change and what the change is.
So that's good advice. If your first draft is an incomprehensible, work backwards.
That's right.
The second element you touched upon is really thinking through the impact on staff, and that's important for a range of reasons, I think, including not just measuring the impact, which is not purely financial. But may have a range of impacts in terms of career advancement or a whole host of other issues. In terms of impact, what are the other reasons to really understand properly and fully the impact that a change proposal has on people?
Well, I mean, you want to go into those processes having considered all the options. So if you are surprised by the potential impacts or potential ramifications of the change you're proposing, it probably means that you haven't thought of all the options. Having said that, one of the benefits of the consultation process is to get other people's perspectives on potential implications and potential solutions. So whilst it's not fatal if you haven't thought of them up front, you probably can be expected to go through that process and learn through that process as well.
Well, I agree. Look, I think it's extraordinarily useful to test internally what the particular scenarios are so that you expand your thinking. However, you haven't satisfied the consultation requirements by simply consulting with yourself.
No, that's true. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, you talked about common sense before, but it's common sense that people doing jobs will probably more likely know the impacts of those on them than a person drafting that change impact statement. You can do as much planning as you can, and you can be as thorough as you can, but nothing's going to replace the actual people it affects looking through that document. So to enable them to do it in the clearest way possible and the most pragmatic ways is being clear about what the change is.
And in terms of that impact, I'm mindful of a couple of things, one of which is we've got that long-standing obligation to seek to mitigate or avert. So you have to understand the impact if you're going to put proposals to mitigate or avert.
Yeah,
I think commonly there's a mistake in terms of proposing or waiting for the consultation process to occur before getting to the mitigate or avert, but it should be in the change impact statement itself.
Yeah, that's right. And that demonstrates that you thought through the implications as far as practicable. I mean, if you've got a change that you need to implement for various reasons, and one has a significant effect on people and one has a lesser effect on people, then you're probably going to pick the lesser one, aren't you? But you're not going to get to that point of choosing the best option unless you've thought through all the options.
One of the items that the agreement makes clear that you need to consider as part of your change impact statement is any impact on occupational health and safety.
Yes, and that rises, I mean, we know that the source of that obligation is elsewhere as well. But it's often a step that can be overlooked in terms of the change impact statement and the industrial process. So it's important that we put that in front and centre as well through this process.
It's interesting. When a change is made for financial reasons, sometimes there's a temptation to only think about the financial effect, whereas there are a range of effects arising from, notwithstanding what the reason for the change is.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, you still, even if that is the drive, you're still not going to be able to implement the change unless you've thought through the whole process, and part of that is the OH&S considerations.
And there's also a requirement that when you provide the change impact statement to provide other supporting material where that's available.
That's right, yeah. And really that supports the premise of the purpose of the consultation process is to be able to have the others influence what that final outcome is. So they're not going to, people aren't going to be able to do that unless they've got all the information required so that they can formulate those alternatives.
And in terms of the next step, once the change impact statement is provided to employees, to their representatives, including the relevant union, the obligation or the opportunity really for the union to meet with its members, and an opportunity for then the employer to meet with the union and the employees to discuss the proposal.
Well, that's right. And this is about the process of having alternative proposals potentially and being able to talk through those.
So the step-by-step process in the clause is really intended to articulate what employers are accustomed to doing, but just really giving it some shape.
That's right.
And what it ought to do is provide a genuine opportunity for there to be an exchange. And it may well be that in some instances change is simply opposed by employees or their representatives. But by the same token, that doesn't necessarily provide the employer with much of an alternative to consider.
No. I mean, it benefits both sides to have alternative proposals generated. That's not always possible, but you would expect that the more proposals that are generated, ultimately the best one will be selected. So in terms of trying to encourage that process, I think employers should be doing it. I mean, part of the benefit of having that process in there is that it stops the arguments about what the process is.
Yes.
So that's the big benefit of trying to articulate a mutually supportive, a supported approach.
And I should say that where there are alternate proposals put forward, one of the obligations on the employer is to really reach a conclusion to the consultation process that has considered those matters and sets out how it is that the change proposal has changed, which in many instances it will.
Yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon through that consultation process for the employer to make changes to their initial proposal. And that should be set out in some sort of document so that there's a record of the process and the outcome.
I think it's worth employers remembering that it's not an arm wrestle, it's not a battle, it is a process of consultation, and the fact that there has been a change is good evidence that the consultation has been genuine.
That's right, yeah.
And just in terms of indicative timeframes, that's a subject of some interest. Some of the agreements have indicative timeframes and some do not. We did start some discussions with a range of unions quite early on about indicative timeframes.
Look, I think, part of the early feedback that we got from both employers and the unions are there's some frustrations around the process. Mm. And that was really resolved around the process itself and also the timelines involved. So that was really the purpose of the indicative timeframes. I mean, whether they're directly in there or not is probably a moot point, because whether you put them in the agreement or the change impact statement itself, there's still an opportunity for the parties to provide some sort of indicative timeframes for the process, because that allows you to measure your progress against what you're anticipating. I mean, they need to be realistic, but given that they're in some agreements, I think they're probably transferable.
So there are probably two things there, one of which is indicative is exactly that, that they're not carved in stone. They are indicative timeframes. Some change processes should be capable of being done in shorter timeframes. Some change processes will demand a longer period of time than those indicative timeframes. But those agreements that don't include the indicative timeframes do have requirements to deal with things in a timely manner. And as per your point, we would recommend that employers include within their change impact statement those timeframes. And that might be a useful guide to employers as to when they might decide that one party perhaps is not being reasonable, to notify a dispute and ultimately seek the assistance of the Commission.
That's right, exactly.
What we know from history is that that the Commission is not a supporter of a bid to simply frustrate change.
And if you look at the history of, I mean, the disputes about consultation process are overrepresented in the number of disputes notified to the Commission, and none that I'm aware of have gone to arbitration off the top of my head, so they do get resolved. Invariably. So a notification to the Commission early on in the process where there are signs that there seems to be some sort of frustration in the process is something I would recommend.
And just in terms of that, I do think there is space for employers to consider when it is appropriate to seek that assistance from the Commission rather than to allow the dispute resolution process or the consultation process to drag on indefinitely.
Yeah, and I think there's always a concern that if it does drag on that staff engagement and can be sort of put under a bit of strain. So I think it's important for employers to take control of these processes, and part of their part of the options open to them is that referral to the Commission. Now, that doesn't take away from the dispute resolution process or the obligations under the agreement to try and to consult and provide the information and cooperate with the process. But ultimately, if there is a view that it is getting frustrated, then seeking the Commission's assistance early on in the process is something I would recommend.
One of the things that really struck me from our earlier discussions and engagements with some of the union parties is that this is not something necessarily that everybody does especially well, and that it is sometimes overly combative. I think there's a real challenge for us as an employer organisation and for the members to seek to change the conversation a little bit and make it less combative if possible.
I mean, by its nature, it should be a collaborative process. This is about.
It's ironic that it is otherwise.
That's right. This is about consulting for the purpose of making better decisions and being able to take people with those decisions. So it's in both parties' interests to facilitate the process as much as possible. No one wins from frustrating these processes or not engaging fully in the consultation process.
And look, I think in terms of overly combative processes that is a very counterproductive thing for the employees affected.
That's right. Yeah, there's nothing worse, in my view, than not having certainty around your employment and around aspects of your employment. So I would have thought the best thing in the context of change and significant change for employees is try and get that certainty as soon as possible.
The last thing I wanted to raise, Tim, is that sometimes there's some debate as to whether or not consultation is required if the change affects a single employee.
Well, I mean, if you look at the extreme example of redundancy, for example, you would find it hard to justify not consulting with that single employee if the effect of the proposed was a redundancy. So, look, in those circumstances, I would have thought that it was very appropriate to consult with that person.
Look, I agree. The consultation requirements do extend to major change that has a significant effect on a single employee. If that wasn't the case, it would be too easy to avoid those obligations.
Yes, so multiples.
You would simply do one after the other, so it does include both.
Yes.
Tim, thank you for your time today and taking us through those consultation provisions. Thank you.
My pleasure.